It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday edition of our program with Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University, and Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. We're engaged in social distancing, so Rachel and Jim not coming into our studios, joining us by phone. Jim and Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Hi there.
Hi, and we've been listening over the last hour to the president, the analysis of or the announcements by the White House Corona Task Force. Well, we are on a war footing, that according to the president, on two fronts, fighting the spread of the virus through ever-tightening restrictions on people's movements, but also stabilizing economies, ours. We can only imagine, severely damaged by what needs to be done to restrict people's contact with each other. A few of the developments, the latest developments, as read from the New York Times, the president invoking the Defense Production Act to increase supplies of vital equipment like ventilators, the Trump administration requesting $500 billion for direct payments to American taxpayers. This is part of that $1 trillion plan. This morning we heard the U.S. and Canada agreeing to close off a border, their border, to non-essential traffic, and Wall Street in turmoil, plunging 7 or 8% down again during that news conference. Let's sort of start big picture before we get a little smaller, if I can say it that way. Jim McCormick, you've been around a few years. You've been looking at politics many years. You've engaged in analyzing crises over decades. What is the magnitude of what we're facing?
Well, I think this is a really extreme kind of challenge that we have. I was thinking about, you know, if you think back to 9/11, certainly 9/11 was a very traumatic experience for the United States with the number of people killed, you know, the attack upon the homeland, something that we had not had. But one of the things that was different about that is that we could identify rather clearly, not fully, but pretty clearly, who the adversary was, and we could sort of target action towards them. And so, you know, that was a way to address this this kind of crisis, if you will. And in 2008 and 2009, when we had the Great Recession, you know, the economic turmoil certainly had people losing their homes and losing jobs and so on. But again, it was a kind of singular targeting on the economic kind of front that we had to deal with. Today, we have, it seems to me, a dual challenge. We have not only this economic challenge that you outlined there in terms of the stock market pivoting up and down and mostly down over the last several days, and we also have this health challenge here. In fact, we don't know really where the adversary is. It could be the next-door neighbor. It could be some person at the gas station, the grocery store, some interaction that we might have. We might pick up this virus. So the problem is we don't know where the adversary is, mm-hmm. and so that makes it even more more uncertain, and that's why I come to the conclusion that this in some ways is even more challenging than these early crises in the 21st century here.
Right. And like 9/11, even though it's been spread out over days, there was just instantaneous. On 9/11, we knew everything had changed.
That's right.
And yeah. we know that now over the course of the last few days. Rachel Caulfield, give us your sense of the magnitude.
I would agree completely with Jim. I'm not sure that we, you know, for several generations now have faced something that is as defining in terms of its political, social, economic consequences. Having said that, you know, I agree we haven't, you know, identification of an adversary is absolutely essential. But when I think back to, for example, 9/11, there was also a clear government response that could occur that would ease the minds of some Americans, at least, right, and would generate some political discussion about the way forward. And so there was this singular event. We could isolate the event, isolate the effects. Kind of in our minds, we could come up with very clear narratives about what was coming next, excuse me, and turning the corner into that next phase. I think right now we're struggling as a nation to determine what the event is, what the effects are, how widespread the effects are. So while we can't identify an adversary, I think we're also really trying to wrap our heads around what this means for us individually, but also what it means for our networks, our economy, our 401ks, mm-hmm. our long-term work,
right.
our, you know, like, we don't know exactly what this is going to look like, and that's hard.
Right. If you have the courage to look at your 401k, that is.
Yes. I would not recommend it for a little while.
Because this is Politics Wednesday, we want to zoom in a little bit after those initial comments to talk about the leadership of our elected officials. And we want to have our conversation with you, our listeners. What is your view of the president's leadership in this crisis? Now, a few days, a few weeks old. What about Congress? What about our governor? Let's talk about leadership, political leadership in the time, in a time of crisis, and we definitely have a doozy here. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Your view of political leadership, our current leadership in this crisis time. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Once again, the phone, 1-866-780-9100. Let me ask you that question to you first, Rachel, on this one. We have seen a change in the way this president has been talking about handling this within the last couple of days, a stark change from what it was a few days ago. What do you make so far of the government handling of the pandemic at a federal level?
Well, I think clearly there is a change. And as you watch the president now, you see a different tone, but you also see a real effort of professionalism, competence, steady leadership. It's still interspersed with periodic, hyperbolic statements, because this is, in fact, President Trump. And that's what he does. But overall, I think, we're seeing more of our bureaucrats come out and talk to the American people directly about the government's efforts. There's been a very clear shift in the message and the messengers and how this is being conveyed to the American people.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of President Trump. These are some clips put together over the past 3 months, talking his reaction to the fast-spreading coronavirus changing over the last 3 months from remaining calm to today's closing of borders.
Whatever happens, we're totally prepared. We have the best people in the world.
Where these people are flying, it's safe to fly. And large portions of the world are very safe to fly. And a big percentage of what we have is when we brought in the 40 or so people from the ship. We brought them in, we immediately quarantined them, but you're adding that to the numbers that we had, which were very small.
To unleash the full power of the federal government in this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency. The action I am taking will open up access to up to $50 billion of very important and a large amount of money for states and territories and localities in our shared fight against this disease.
I don't take responsibility at all, because we were given a set of circumstances, and we were given rules, regulations, and specifications from a different time. Wasn't meant for this kind of an event with the kind of numbers that we're talking about.
Okay, some of the president's reactions over the past 3 months or so, a few of the clips there. Now to you, Jim. Talk about your view of this evolution of the president's attitude and messaging to the American people.
Yeah, there's really been a stark change, it seems to me. I mean, as you evidenced over just these past few days, having these daily news conferences or press conferences here in which he has all of these experts speaking about what they're doing and what they're trying to work out and so on. I mean, the urgency really has been put front and center, I think, with those kind of daily briefings. And probably the president's had taken more questions in the last few days here than he did for, several weeks with regard to this crisis. I think what happened, at least if we can sort of piece it together, is that, he took the action with regard to closing the travel to and from China. I suspect he must have thought that was sufficient, but then What I suspect surprised him was how it exploded in Europe, and particularly in Italy, and now gone beyond Italy and France and Germany. And I suspect that is what sort of began to change his attitude, you know, in terms of that he's really got to get a grip on this, because it's not just coming and he thinks he could kind of hold it with regard to China, but that was not going to really be possible.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, do you think Donald Trump will face any political consequences for his weeks and weeks of downplaying this threat and then his sudden about face?
It's really hard to tell at this time. We have no idea how long this is going to last. We have no idea what, in the end, what kind of federal government response is going to be necessary. There are so many unknowns at this point. You know, I could envision a scenario where over the coming, say, 2 months, much of this comes under control. The federal government appears to be competent, capable, helpful. And if that happens, Americans can have a very short-term political memory. We can embrace that wholeheartedly. You know, November is actually a very long way away in our current political environment.
Okay, join our conversation.
You know, I think,
Go ahead, Jim. Go ahead, Jim.
No, I was thinking that, you know, one of the things, you know, the president talks about, you know, the economy is going to pop after we get, you know, through this. I think that that's probably, you know, myopic. You know, I'm not sure that that's really going to be possible, you know, because, yes, there'll be some pent-up demand and so on, but I'm not sure the economy will gin up as fast. And I think the consequences will be that we'll kind of see a change in the opposition. They'll run on the economy as well as the leadership. And before, they were sort of saying, really questioning the leadership of the president and, you know, the past 3 years. Now it well might become the economy for the Democrats if it really continues to stall, which I can't imagine a quick recovery. But, you know, as Rachel said, there's a lot of unknowns here.
There are.
It's a long time to November.
There are. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, our political scientists on board on this momentous Wednesday of happenings. I guess momentous will probably be tagged on to every day for the foreseeable future in some way with all the developments that we're having. Join our conversation as we ask, what is your view of the president's leadership in this crisis? What about Congress? What about our governor? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Rachel and Jim joining us from, I believe, their homes. Rachel, we are engaged in the social distancing, as everyone should be, and we hear your dog in the distance there, but that is fine.
That
is absolutely. I just wanted to mention that because people may wonder what it is. You're at home. There's your dog.
Yeah.
Everything's fine.
That's right. Exactly. She's very happy to have me home for a few weeks.
All right. Let's go to our first caller in West Des Moines. Kelly is with us. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to our program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
One of the questions, well, the first question initially was, how do we feel our leadership is doing at this time? And truthfully, it's very hard to have any type of leadership from a person who literally just said on Friday he takes no responsibility for it, but then turns around yesterday and says that everyone should be thanking him for their response. So in order to have, and actually on March 9th, he blamed the Democratic Party for inflaming the coronavirus situation. So it's hard to have any leadership coming from someone who is completely and utterly in his own world. He narcissistic personality. He's been diagnosed by multiple professionals that he's got many different personality disorders. So,
Kelly, I'm sure a lot of people are with you on the points that you made, but let me ask you, we have this president at this time during this crisis in the last couple of days. How do you feel about the different attitude, the different messaging coming from President Trump and the coronavirus task force?
Well, it seems that he's actually now has heard enough from the professionals that surround him that he hasn't gotten rid of yet. But it sounds as though he's actually taking a point to to listen to the people who are in charge and who have an idea of what needs to be done. So it's about time that he takes a step back and lets other people be in charge and not himself. I agree with the stimulus package. I agree with providing. We've never seen this before. There's never been any type where we have to have social isolation. So the stimulus package is great. I just wish he wouldn't have taken a whole bunch of money out of the federal government to go ahead and build a wall that we could have helped. It could have helped use for this point in time.
Kelly, thank you for your view from West Des Moines. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Rachel, I wonder if you can one of the political stories we've been following for months is he has had quick turnover in his cabinet, in his White House staff there. Our caller there was just referencing listening to the people around him. Does he have the people around him? A lot of the people around him have left the administration or been fired, right?
Yeah, this has been a pretty tumultuous administration, presidential administration. And so this is one of those moments where we realize the value of the little-known bureaucrat kind of focusing in on what may seem minor on a day-to-day basis until we need their knowledge, until we need that expertise. And then all of a sudden we realize that that position might be incredibly important in policymaking and in responding to a crisis. This is an administration where we've had a lot of people, not just political appointees, but staff as well, who have left, some under very contentious circumstances, some have been fired, some have simply walked away because they disagree pretty significantly with the way the president has approached the task of managing the executive branch. And so right now we have a lot of vacancies in top level positions, and that's becoming more and more apparent, I think. It's also perhaps one of the reasons why we're seeing so many people during these daily briefings, so many people called to the podium to talk about what they know and what government response is. You can want to drain the swamp and get rid of so many federal bureaucrats until you need them. And then when you need them, you may find that they're not there, mm-hmm. and that can produce or compound problems.
Let's go back to our phones. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, and you join our conversation. Your view of political leadership at this time of crisis. Emily in Wilton, welcome to the program. We're coming up on a break. I'll ask you to be concise, Emily. Welcome to the program.
Thank you kindly. I'm trying to take notes so I can try to keep it concise.
All right. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said you were on a break. I just wanted to say that besides political leadership, I think we each have a role in providing some leadership in the way we speak about all of this. And I don't want to chastise, because I think the world of your program and your speakers, but I think the point is that coronavirus is the enemy, not each other. So we don't have to wonder if it's our enemy, if our enemy is our neighbor. The enemy is the virus,
right?
And we need to learn as much as we can about it, because that's how we're going to combat it most effectively. And the media has a lot of power in driving the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this provides a real opportunity to get us away from all this bipartisan polarization and look at the question of what is the role of government? What do we want government to do for us? We probably want them to collect the garbage. We probably want them to maintain the roads. And we're probably learning that we want them to protect public health. And I think that's it's an opportunity, because it's not partisan right now.
Emily.
So that's all I'll take.
Yeah. Emily, I just wanted to say we're reading from the same page. Emily and Wilton here, because I was thinking about that this morning, too, as I was kind of preparing what to talk with Rachel and Jim about. For years, to put it a different way than Emily did, she put it eloquently, but we have, as Americans, Republicans and Democrats, across the political spectrum, yearned for a less partisan atmosphere in this country. Jim, do you think this is I don't know.
I think this is the moment.
This is the moment.
Yeah, it really is, because I think it's been evident even in the past days here. You know, getting the second package, through the House over the weekend, and apparently it's going to be voted on today. I mean, I think there's been a different tone in terms of both Democrats and Republicans saying they got to really do something in terms of both public health and the economy. I'm not sure they're not going to rally, I suppose, that much immediately around the president, but they're going to rally around the American people. And that's become really evident. And, you know, this $1 trillion package that they're putting together as a third bill with regard to this virus here is really quite phenomenal, because usually you would hear, and maybe you will still hear some carping about, you know, deficit spending and all of that. But now there's this kind of urgency, this emergency, and I think that this is indeed the moment.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, in what way, if it will this unify us?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that we as a country do well when we face a common and collective problem. And sometimes that can take the form of a common enemy. Sometimes, in this case, it can take the form of a common cause. It is true that there are Americans right now who are deeply frustrated with fellow Americans, people who are not sheltering in place, people who are perhaps behaving irresponsibly by continuing to go out and, you know, interact with people regardless of the potential consequences of that interaction. But there are also people all around the country who are doing some amazing things, who are volunteering to help their neighbors, who are putting themselves, you know, out on Facebook or other social media, volunteering to help in a responsible way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's incredibly important. So you can hear the president saying, this is our common cause, come together. And this is one of the benefits of that wartime rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Rachel Caulfield, stay there at home. Give your dog a treat, maybe. Jim McCormick with us as well from Iowa State University. They're joining us from their homes because, of course, we're practicing social distancing. People not in our studio for the foreseeable future. Want to have you join our conversation as we discuss political leadership in this crisis. What about Congress? What about our governor? We'll be back after just a moment, and hopefully you'll be joining us. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment with Rachel Caulfield and Jim McCormick. So glad you're on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Jim McCormick and Rachel Caulfield, our political scientists this hour. Rachel of Drake University, Jim of Iowa State University. We're talking about political leadership in a time of crisis. And even though we are in the very early stages of dealing with this particular crisis, we do know that this past week we entered a new era that we will remember and will be remembered for generations. We will undoubtedly talk in terms of before and after the pandemic. There are now known coronavirus cases in all 50 states. As of this morning, the U.S. has more than 5,800 confirmed cases. At least 107 patients have died. We are dreading those numbers, which will undoubtedly jump much higher in the coming days and weeks. Six more Iowans have been diagnosed with COVID-19. That's the largest single-day jump in cases. It brings the total here in Iowa to 29. According to the Iowa Department of Public Health, three of those new cases are residents of Johnson County, and one each from Adair, Black Hawk, and Dallas counties. It's been 24 hours since all restaurants and bars in Iowa have closed to dine-in service. The governor's order there until at least April 1st. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. We're talking about political leadership, and if perhaps this crisis brings us to a remake of or some kind of overhaul of our same old partisan politics. June in Johnston, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a retired healthcare professional, And I must say I'm beyond disappointed, dismayed at the response of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention over particularly the testing. As you know, that was woefully behind. The tests were an error to start with. And, you know, we really should be at a much faster clip of getting those kinds of diagnostic tests out. So I guess I have two questions for the guests. One is, do you think that the political appointment of the head of the CDC being relatively recent, is that a contributing factor? Do we have someone at the helm who's really not capable of showing the kind of leadership we need? And then my second question is, what do you see after the smoke has cleared in terms of what might be examined in the CDC to do things differently in the future? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you very much. June calling from Johnston. That would be Robert Redfield, the 18th director of the Center for Disease Control, I think she's referring to. Who wants to tackle that? Jim, we're back sort of to the people that the president surrounds himself with.
Well, that's right. And, you know, obviously the kind of turnover that Rachel was talking about in the first half hour here, in the administration, you know, and it's obviously evident with the CDC. One of the things that I noticed in that press conference this morning, or news conference, I guess, and press conference this morning, was that Dr. Birx, who explained that in terms of the testing, you know, that some of the platforms that they were using were really inadequate to really speed up the number of tests, but that has now changed. And so maybe we'll see an increase in the number of, or at least she predicted that within the week's time, we'll see a very rapid increase. So part of it is in terms of the kind of platform and capabilities that they had. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that could obviously turn on the role of the leadership here. Whether that will really eventuate in a rapid increase, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But that's sort of the expectation. But there's it's hard to explain why it took so long for a better developed country like the United States with lots of professionals that they weren't better prepared to engage in this kind of testing.
Well, piggyback on your comment and on the caller's question there, we know there's a claim being made in various reports that sort of the heart of the question is, did Donald Trump fire pandemic officials and defund the CDC? Now, this is according, I'm going to read the judgment according to the nonpartisan PolitiFact, which is part of the Poynter Institute, to quote a summary of the answer to these questions. According to them, fired may be a little strong, but in 2018, top national security officials handling pandemics left abruptly. They were not replaced by the Trump administration. As for funding, the second question, they write, there's no question that the Trump administration sought to cut key CDC budget categories. But thanks to Congress, that funding was restored and even increased in bills that President Trump ultimately signed. They go on. In other words, it's not accurate to say that Trump has been defunding the CDC, but he has tried to make cuts in key programs. It's just that Congress didn't listen. End of the quote from PolitiFact on that question that's been in a lot of reports. Rachel, weigh in on this.
Well, this is one of those great instances where until you need them, the CDC and all the money that goes into the CDC may seem unnecessary or unhelpful. And so it may seem like a line item in the budget that could easily be cut just a little bit here and there, trimmed down to make government more efficient and more effective and you know, save some money. And in a non-emergency situation, that may seem to be a wise decision, or at least not a bad decision. And then, of course, when you do face an emergency situation, the CDC becomes incredibly important to a coordinated and coherent national response, and you start to see the effects of defunding over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the consequences is going to be, you know, the second part of that person's comment was, what's the future going to look like? And obviously, this is should be a wake-up call both for the Congress and for the president here. in terms of not only leadership, but in terms of funding for the CDC.
So much to talk about, so little of the hour left to talk about it. We have callers, Jim and Rachel. Let's go to our callers. I'll ask our callers to be brief so we can accommodate as many different views as possible this hour. Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, if you've just joined us. Let's go to Greg. Greg, I see on my screen you're calling from Iowa City.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please. Welcome.
Well, you know, everybody has their questions right now, and I very much appreciate, you know, the wide breadth of knowledge that everybody's bringing to the table. But as pertaining to leadership, you know, anybody who listened to that news conference or press conference or whatever you care to call it, there was not leadership, unfortunately. You know, there was a lot of rambling. It's very clear that there's not leadership here. And so it kind of got me thinking along the lines of, well, you know, ostensibly, politicians are our employees. And in an election year especially, they're more concerned with getting their jobs, keeping their jobs, than a lot of other things. And I've seen the tone of this administration shift so rapidly over the past few days that I can't help but wonder if perhaps this response is just as politically motivated as the lack of response was before.
Okay.
You know, before there were reports of this administration sort of suppressing this as an issue because, you know, a pandemic isn't good for re-election.
Okay, Greg, thank you very much. We have other callers. You've made your point. We're going to move on. Greg calling from Iowa City. Let's go to Ken in Ames. Ken, share your opinion.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Ben. I agree with the and understand the need for $1 trillion stimulus. But do we need to revisit the tax cut and huge deficit? I mean, we've got a recession that's going to decrease tax revenue, and the deficit is already in the range of $1 trillion for this year. So how do we avoid the hazards of an unsustainable national debt, especially in light of the tax giveaway by this Congress and administration?
Right. Ken, a good point. But I guess if we're seeing this as the House being on fire, I guess that's secondary to getting the hoses, the fire trucks there to put the fire out. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I do. But I guess long-term consequences and the other kinds of pandemics that might occur, I think this is a completely unsustainable course that we're going economically.
Okay. Thank you, Ken, calling there. Let's go to Mike in Spencer. Our quick hits to the phones. Mike, running out of time, but we're sure glad to have you.
Hi.
From Spencer. Welcome.
Well, Mike, there's one little aspect of this thing that I don't think has been addressed. It has to do with my opinion, which is that Trump, in his wild and crazy ways, has an obsession about undoing Obama. And I understand that this defunding and all of this stuff, I thought the whole part of it had been taken out. But if he had not taken action that he did in his erstwhile attempt to un-Obama everybody, I think he is responsible 100% for the disaster that we're in.
Mike,
and I will get off the air.
Mike in Spencer, thank you very much for your view. Wanted to get to one more aspect of our political landscape, ignoring so many things that did happen. But I wanted to address yesterday the fact that Joe Biden easily defeated Bernie Sanders in Arizona, Florida, and Illinois. Remember, Ohio decided not to have their primary yesterday. Let's listen to part of Biden's brief victory address last night to no audience. He says he and Sanders may disagree on tactics, but they share a common vision.
The coronavirus doesn't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. It will not discriminate based on national origin, race, gender, or your zip code. It will touch people in positions of power, as well as the most vulnerable people in our society. We're all in this together. This is a moment for each of us to see and believe the best in every one of us, to look out for our neighbor, to understand the fear and stress that so many are feeling, to care for the elderly couple down the street, to thank the healthcare worker, the doctors, the nurses, the pharmacists, the grocery store cashier, and the people restocking the shelves, to believe in one another. Because I assure you, when we do that, when we see the best in each of us, we lift this nation up and we'll get through this together. That's how we've always done it.
former Vice President Joe Biden after his defeating the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in Arizona, Florida, and Illinois by quite wide margins. The AP, other news sources reporting that the Sanders campaign is reassessing, not dropping out, according to the latest information that I have. Rachel Caulfield, let's go to you on this. Of course, the big question is how this crisis colors the rest of the campaign season. But let's just address Joe Biden right now. Is this a pivot point for the former vice president, where you hear him in that speech perhaps turning his attention to the general election and a different opponent, not Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I think he's been making that shift for the past couple of weeks as he repositions himself and focuses on a broader electorate. You know, and to the caller's points, different people are going to read the situation in different ways politically, and they hear different things from Donald Trump. It's an opportunity for Joe Biden to frame his own national message. And I think the kind of steady leadership that Joe Biden has been offering and talking about, all of a sudden, it doesn't seem boring. It seems incredibly relevant to a lot of people.
Interesting. Jim, your read on where Joe Biden is, where this primary race is. It's all but locked up for Joe Biden, right? He's got between 1,100 and 1,200 delegates now, I think, and he needs 1,900 some to have the nomination.
1,991, I think, the number. I think Rachel's point is right on. He's shifted his tone. He's appealed for that kind of unity, and that's going to be the kind of message I think we'll see throughout the campaign. I'm not sure how long that, you know, with this reassessment that Bernie Sanders is going to go through, how long he'll want to stay in, you know, in the contest here, whether he'll want to go with these other primaries or not, or spin out. But I think sort of Biden with the, you know, 1,100, as you said, delegates that he's got already, and, you know, the subsequent primaries are probably going to get him very quickly to that 1,900 number, you know, that he's in a very good position to simply start looking for the general election debate rather than talking about any kind of primary debate.
Mm-hmm. The numbers there now, 1,991 for the nomination, as
yeah.
You said there, Jim. Joe Biden at present with 1,165, Bernie Sanders 880. Rachel, we will not have any rallies for the foreseeable future, maybe for the rest of this election campaign. How will the pandemic, in that way and other ways, shape the rest of this primary season, this coming general election season?
Well, this is one of the big unknowns. The fact that we're in the middle of a presidential election while this is occurring, you know, there's no way that this doesn't become the predominant question in voters' minds. And we're going to see shifts in policy. You know, as one of the callers referenced, for example, the tax breaks that were passed by Congress and the president. That's a policy conversation that will continue for a long time as we see how much money needs to be spent to work our way through this crisis. Healthcare becomes a different debate now as a result of this crisis. Draining the swamp becomes a different conversation now as a result of this crisis. And so the entire, you know, political landscape kind of, it just shifts under the feet of these candidates. And the candidates are now going to have to try to find a new footing. For Bernie Sanders, I think it's an interesting scenario right now because over the course of the next month, I believe there are only three states that will be voting, and they're all small states. I think it's Alaska and Hawaii and Wyoming. And so, you know, this is not a situation where at least over the next several weeks, the tone and tenor of the Democratic race will change. He may determine that it's worth it to stay in the race, at least in the short term, and see how it goes, see if there's any significant change on the horizon in the next 4 weeks. I don't think we know exactly what this portends for the presidential election, but it certainly has the potential to change the entire nature of the political conversation in the United States.
Last week on this program, neither of you were with us at that time, but Bernie Sanders had suffered that defeat of last week, the slew of primaries going against him. And in reaching out to listeners, we had at least two callers, I think one that didn't get on, Bernie Sanders supporters I was asking to call. And two of them who were on the air said that if Joe Biden gets the nomination, they would not support Joe Biden. In fact, they would vote Trump. Now, that could have been the anger, the disappointment of the moment. Jim McCormick, let me put it to you. What is the challenge for Joe Biden to unify the party, and what kind of help does he need from Bernie Sanders?
Well, he needs the help, I think, in two areas. The one, of course, is to try to get Bernie Sanders to rally young people to vote for Biden and support him. And the other, of course, is, and I think we've already seen this in the debate Sunday night on CNN, in which the Biden actually moved in a number of progressive directions, really to try to attract some of the Sanders supporters. But you have to keep in mind, the polling data from 2016 showed that about 7 or 8% of Sanders supporters, now there was a little bit different context there, actually ended up voting for Trump because they were disappointed, in terms of Sanders' efforts with regard to getting the nomination away from Hillary Clinton here. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's still that discontent, as that one caller that you pointed to from last week, that there will be some that will be voting or will probably turn to Trump in sort of a protest way. But I think Biden has already made the move. Mm-hmm. In terms of asking, he'll probably have to ask Bernie to rally the younger folks, to make the millennials come out and really vote, and as well as support him. And to make some changes in terms of his policy positions, whether it's on, on health care or on social issues, which he seemingly has already done. I think the other way the campaign is going to change, though, is that we're going to see a lot of television, a lot of television ads, since there's no other way, or that's the principal way. I don't think we're going to see the kind of debates where we have no audiences. That I'm not sure that people are can sustain the interest that way.
Actually, I don't know about you, Jim and Rachel. I found it kind of refreshing not to have to deal with the applause lines and to just be able to listen to the arguments and the dynamic, the interaction of the two.
Yeah, but I think the energy level is there when you have, when you have an audience and we have some responses to it. Although, yeah. I mean, I take your point.
Yep.
Listening, you could actually listen when you only have two candidates, for one thing.
Exactly.
And you could sort of cut through what their positions were. So that, in that sense, it was refreshing. Mm-hmm. But I think Trump has another problem because, he really kind of feeds off these rallies that he has, and those rallies are not going to be possible anymore.
That's a good point. That's been a hallmark of Donald Trump, those rallies. Rachel Caulfield, I have about 50 seconds for you. Give us a concluding thought to take us away out of this hour.
Well, I think one of the most important things we can all do right now is, A, take care of ourselves, but take care of each other. But also to take a step back every so often and think about how this changes our perceptions of our government, of our leaders, and to kind of step away from our own partisanship as well and think about how our local, our state, and our national governments are all working together and how we can participate in that, how we can facilitate their action and make our communities stronger as a result of all of this.
Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jim and Rachel, thank you for spending the hour with us. And thank you, listeners, for chipping into our discussion. Many more to come as we work through this crisis together. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we know large parts of our economy have nearly ground to a halt. We don't know for how long. Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear from Iowans whose lives and work have been suddenly and completely upended by this pandemic. We'll also talk lost jobs with the Deputy Director of Iowa Workforce Development. Has your life, your job been completely upended? Join our discussion tomorrow, Thursday, on this program. We'll talk about it and perhaps have some solutions or at least some guidance. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.